Translator, it's a little shy, so I'll move this back over here.
She's our translator.
But she will help Rinpoche if he has any problems. So welcome, everybody, to our guest speaker series. It's been a while since we've done one, but now we've finally gotten one together after a couple of years.
It's a little shy, so I'll move this back over here.
She's our translator.
But she will help Rinpoche if he has any problems. So welcome, everybody, to our guest speaker series. That's what happens when the host is also the tech person. Got to be two people at once. Okay, so again, welcome, everybody. My name is Melvin. I'll be your host for this afternoon. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Today is our guest speaker series, and it's entitled How the Mind Works. The mind is that which enables consciousness, perception, thinking, judgment, and memory. And perhaps the mind is the most complex part of being a sentient human being. So the Buddhist approach to the mind, first and foremost, is one sees the potential for its development, and developing the mind, becoming a kinder person, and eventually becoming enlightened. With a Western psychological viewpoint is understanding behavior, the personality of the mind, and some extent changing the mind. So today we have the great honor to have two highly educated academics from both of their individual fields and respective traditions here to discuss the similarities and differences between Western psychology and the Buddhist perspective in regards to the mind and how it works. And first I would like to introduce our honored guest, Dr. Azad Paul Kirkjian. He's a certified adult and child psychiatrist, specializing in psychiatry, and serving as a medical director of the Memorial Care Center for Mental Health and Wellness at the Community Hospital in Long Beach. He has an undergraduate degree in psychology from UC San Diego and also a medical degree from Drexel University. And right here on your right is our resident teacher, Geshe Tenzin Chopel Rinpoche. Rinpoche received his Geshe Larampa degree in 2010, which is equivalent to a PhD degree in Buddhist studies. Chopel Rinpoche has been teaching various topics in Tibetan Buddhism here at the center since 2012, and he's taught such classes like calm abiding meditation and Lorig, the presentation of awareness and knowledge, kind of the perspective of the mind in Tibetan Buddhism. So first we will begin with opening remarks and an overview of how the mind works from Dr. Kirkjian and Rinpoche from their own respective traditions. After that, we will invite the speakers to respond to each other by giving them an opportunity to discuss any similarities and differences between the traditions that they see. And then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. So first, we will begin with Dr. Kirkjian.
Thank you for having me, everyone. So given that the field of psychology is so diverse and so wide, I decided to keep it very simple. I was going to just discuss two basic types of psychological schools of thought. And sometimes people confuse psychiatrists with a psychologist. So I am a psychiatrist, but I have a unique background in that I was also trained psychologically. So most schools now, they just focus on teaching psychiatrists how to manage psychiatric medications. But during my residency program, I went to UC San Diego for college, and I was a psychology major there. And I went to medical school for 4 years at Drexel University. After that, I did my residency training at UCLA for 4 years. I with a lot of veterans there, dealt with a lot of PTSD. I did groups. So I also had 13 weekly therapy patients during my residency training. So that means I saw a patient for 1 hour a week. And with four of those patients, I would discuss them with one of my supervisors. So I had three supervisors, and I would meet with each supervisor once a week to discuss each patient. So even though most of my training was with medication, I did get some experience in doing therapy with individuals. So that the last time I actually formally did therapy was around 2010. Most of my work now focuses on medication management. However, my experience in therapy has helped me determine which patients or what kind of therapy a certain patient would benefit from. And you know, forgive me, I'm not that knowledgeable about Buddhism, but I just wanted to make one statement, and maybe you guys could help me clarify later. I just had the stereotype that maybe whereas Buddhism might be more of a study of universal, it may be more of a study of universally accepted body of truths. Psychology, with all its different schools of thought, is a collection of suppositions and concepts based on clinical experience and observations. So I wanted to also read a passage from a book that I thought might be very interesting and underlying how different schools of psychology may have different perspectives on people and clinical situations. So this is from a book about object relations and self-psychology. So that's one field of therapy that really caught my interest during my training. And so basically it talks about Cinderella as an illustration. So a well-known story can serve as a case study to illustrate the different approaches each of these three theoretical models might take to the same patient. In actuality, therapists tend to work in similar ways, whereas conceptual models have greater differences. So let us suppose that Cinderella and the prince got married, but marital problems have arisen, and she seeks the help of a therapist. A traditional Freudian might investigate Cinderella's repression of her sexual instincts and the unresolved Oedipal feelings she had for her parents. This therapist or analyst would then analyze Cinderella's problems in terms of defenses and conflicts between the structures of the ego and the id. A therapist working with an object relations perspective would note that Cinderella suffered early psychological deprivation from the loss of her mother. Possibly this loss caused Cinderella to make use of the psychological defense mechanism of splitting, by which she idealized some women, such as her fairy godmother, and saw other women as, quote, all bad, end quote, her stepsisters and stepmother. She idealized the prince, knowing him only for a short time. A marriage based on such distorted inner images of herself and others is bound to run into problems, as she sooner or later must deal with the prince as a real person with human flaws. In object relations theory, the issue would center on the discrepancy between Cinderella's inner world and the person and situations of the actual world. A therapist or analyst working within the framework of self-psychology would attend to the experiences that Cinderella had of herself in therapy as an experience is manifested in the transference to the therapist. Analysis of her transference might reveal an impoverished self that needed a powerful and idealized object. Cinderella's search for such an object reflects her lack of self-esteem and her need to be affirmed by such idealized object, whether in the form of a fairy godmother, the prince, or the therapist. She needed to fuse the idealized prince out of hope for a feeling of well-being. One of out of touch with her own inner emptiness and angry feelings, Cinderella might either idealize her therapist or view her therapist the way she viewed her stepmother. So I think this was an interesting, funny story just to help point out that even with this fable of Cinderella, if you look at it, you could look at it from various perspectives, from the Freudian perspective, from the object relations perspective, and also the biological perspective. So a lot of these earlier therapies, for example, with Freud, when there is a incomplete development of your Oedipal stage when you're an infant, sometimes you develop defense mechanisms to deal with that unresolved issue. So the job of a therapist is to help deal with those defense mechanisms and maybe help resolve that early Oedipal conflict, for example. An object relations therapist would differ in their approach. So, but from my perspective as a psychiatrist, I've also seen that there are a lot of, is my mic working?
Yeah.
There's a lot of contributing.
Bacteria.
Yeah. There's a lot of factors that contribute to mental illness. For example, people used to think that schizophrenia was due to an unnurturing mother or someone who didn't validate the child or feed them or these kind of theories. So a lot of these older psychological theories have fallen out of favor now. And so it's easier for me to identify conditions like bipolar or schizophrenia or ADHD. There are a lot of other psychological symptoms like depression or personality disorders that fall into an area where these symptoms tend to develop as a result of failed relationships or a lot of traumas early on in life. So there's always controversy about medications and the role of medications versus the role of therapy. So the way that I would like to give a metaphor about that is that medications, well, let me give you an example. Let's say there is a class. Let's say the teacher is trying to teach some information to the students. And the information that is being taught to the students is what a therapist does for a patient. Let's say that someone behind the student has a boombox radio playing, and the volume of the boombox is very loud so that none of the information that the teacher is giving the student is being absorbed by the student. So the role that I see medications is that medications are the hand on the volume that lowers the volume of that boombox that allows that student to then listen to what the teacher has to say and learn from the lecture. So the way I see medications is that they might be a temporary solution to help people's symptoms so that they could learn to resolve their past conflicts in therapy. And I think there is a well established evidence that medications alone are not as good as are equal to therapy alone. But when you do medications plus therapy together, the Western philosophy is that you have the most favorable outcome when you combine the two. So I'm a strong believer in therapy, even though my role is more to manage medication. I also feel that therapy is essential in learning how to break patterns that are very ingrained in us or very hard to break. And so that's just my concept of how medications could help different people with different situations. So the two major theories of therapy that I wanted to discuss is psychodynamic therapy versus cognitive behavior therapy. So there's a lot of research now showing that cognitive behavior therapy is very effective. Some people have argued that the results of cognitive behavior therapy are very short term, and that psychodynamic therapy is something that is much longer lasting, but it is more difficult sometimes to work through defense mechanisms. But I just wanted to give an example of how cognitive behavior therapy works according to the Western philosophy. So cognitive behavior therapy is that when people have a lot of automatic negative thoughts, so sometimes these thoughts are not logical. You could have an automatic negative thought such as, for example, I'm not good enough. No matter what I do, things are never going to get better. No matter how hard I try, I'm never going to succeed. So sometimes these thoughts are almost like a radio that's just playing in your head over and over again. So what cognitive behavior therapy does is that the therapist sits with a patient and they try to identify all of these automatic negative thoughts that sometimes they just pop into your head. So once it takes a long time to even identify these thoughts because sometimes we're not even aware of them. They're just beliefs that we have about ourselves that just pop into our heads. So in cognitive behavior therapy, you identify the 10 most common automatic negative thoughts you have in your head, just to give you an example. And what you do is that you make a hierarchy from number 1 to number 10. Let's say number 1 is the most fearful thought, the most ingrained automatic negative thought you have. And then that's the most difficult to change. So you start with the least fearful one. Like you start with number 10, which is, it's an automatic negative thought, but it doesn't have so much control or power over you. So as you start with the least dangerous negative thought, you slowly challenge those automatic negative thoughts with evidence of different things that you have achieved in your life, different successes that you've had. So you're basically like a lawyer in court trying to present evidence contrary to the fact of that negative thought that is going off in your head. So it's a very cumbersome process. It involves workbooks. It involves constantly challenging these automatic negative thoughts. But eventually you work yourself up from number 10 to number 9. You reach eventually number 1, where sooner or later you will be able to contradict these illogical negative emotions that automatically pop into your head. So that's cognitive behavior therapy. It's a very kind of concrete type of therapy. Whereas in psychodynamic therapy, which was based a lot on Freudian principles, there are 3 constructs. Those basic constructs are the id, the ego, and the superego. So the id is our basic instinctual drives and desires, like our sex drive or desire for food. The ego is kind of, it represents the part of our brain that's like the referee between the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. So when someone has a diffuse ego, some people who work in this concept say that they never have internalized, their ego is very diffuse, so they could develop a condition like schizophrenia, for example. I tend to believe that schizophrenia might be more of a biological illness versus a psychological illness, but this is just the perspective of a dynamic therapy. So in dynamic therapy, what happens is that you try to... So continuing further is the superego. Superego is the internalization of our parents' conscience. And it's the internalization of the rules of society. So it's kind of like the boundary that holds us together. The ego is like the referee between our conscious mind and our unconscious mind. And the id is our primal primitive drives and instincts. So sometimes if you have an unresolved developmental trauma, your id, your instinctual drives could really take over your life and cause a lot of problems. So the ego desperately tries to repress the id. When you repress your inner instincts, you develop neuroses and all sorts of anxiety symptoms and defense mechanisms. So what a therapist tries to do is they try to identify defense mechanisms so that you could eventually resolve some of these early conflicts early on in life. So I know it's a lot of words and it's very complicated, but I just wanted to point out that psychology is not a unified concept, but it's just... as I mentioned earlier, a bunch of suppositions based on clinical observations and experiences. And one of the beautiful things that I enjoy about therapy is that in psychodynamic therapy, what is analyzed is the transference. So the term transference is the feelings a patient develops or projects towards the therapist. When the therapist can identify transference and correct any discrepancies or conflict that come up between the patient and the therapist, in a way it's kind of like a corrective emotional experience. And for it helps people who have maybe had very invalidating relationships with their primary caregivers growing up. So by analyzing transference, that's how therapy works for people, and it helps them to correct their emotional experiences in relation to other people. And like I said, the way I view medication is that it helps decrease intense symptoms so that you can actually understand and logically think through issues in therapy in a calm fashion where your brain is not overwhelmed with obsessive thoughts or delusions or that kind of thing. So so basically, that kind of sums things up in a nutshell for me. I don't know if I'm... I have 5 minutes left, but
okay. Thank you, Dr. Kirkin. Now I'd like to invite Rinpoche to give a little opening remarks and an overview of the mind in Tibetan Buddhism.
Okay. First, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. So first, I would like to do Tibetan traditional, the offer kind of this before introduce or before speech. So this is Tibetan traditional. Yeah, this Tibetan tradition. Okay, so today is really is very special day in Tibetan traditional way. Actually, today is a day of starting with a Sakadawa. It's for Buddha's birthday and reborn, and then what is it? It attain enlightenment. So that is also special day, and so also this traditional of Tibetan Buddhism. During 1 month, they don't eat meat, and they try to do positive way. It's a kind of Tibetan traditional. Second, tomorrow is Mother Day, so I wish everybody have happy Mother Day. So here, yeah, it's actually I'm really familiar about therapies and also Western psychology. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So actually, also I took some psychology class in my college. It's kind of, how do we say, it's totally different view of Tibetan Buddhist mind, and then view of psychologies. It's very different. So actually here in the Tibetan Buddhism days, actually they, we have in, what do you say, in the fundamental view of in Tibetan Buddhism, the dependent origination. Dependent origination, we say actually it states the cause and effect. Yeah. Cause and effect, usually we say cause and effects, it refers to the, actually, is there are two kind of categories of cause and effect. We say, physical, external cause and effect, and then internal cause and effect. So, physical, external cause and effect, and then, internal cause and effects is, usually is really crucial to Tibetan Buddhist, to practice. Also, it's really related to cause and effect, kind of, is really related to the all sentient beings suffering, and sentient beings pain. Also, sentient beings, all beings happiness and peace. Yeah, cause and effect. So, also here, actually, there's a, we have lost our problem from we have really kind of, we have suffering, then we have pain, then we sick, we have disease. Those all kind of in Buddhist perspective way, they say like those all are come from the project from your mind, and it's from your mental disorder. Yeah, it's kind of your defilement of mind. Also, we say those all problems is related to the karma. In Tibetan Buddhism, we say is a karma, is related to the karma. So, but actually in Tibetan Buddhism, they really don't have specific kind of those disease, and there's no specific to cure or specific to heal those kind of illness. Usually we say those kind of illness, we have kind of mental disorder, then and lots of what we say mental disorder. There actually many kinds of disease, yeah. But anyway, some disease is coming from the external things, like we have kind of physical disease. Sometimes it's kind of physical diseases come from external things, like kind of lack of diet and something wrong eating we have, yeah. But anyway, those kind of disease all are related to the karma, yeah. Related to the karma means those all disease. Anyway, you have external disease and internal disease, mental disease. Those all related to the karma means usually we is the karma is just like kind of invisible action, is invisible action, and everything created by karma. Everything created by karma and everything created by mind. Yeah. Usually we say karma has three types of karma. We say verbal, yeah? Verbal, yeah, three karma. It's a physical action. Karma means we say action. Physical action and mental action and kind of verbal action, yeah? Yeah, speech action, yeah? Yeah, body, speech, and mind, yeah? Everything, those kind of all disease create, caused by those three actions. Yeah? Those three actions create by our create or cause, yeah? Is caused by what do we say? Mental disorder, kind of defilement is the kind of what do we say? How to say? Is a defilement or kind of defilement of mental or delusion of mental. Usually we have mental days. Actually, it's very difficult to explain in Tibetan Buddhist view of mental. A lot of the part of mental. So all kind of those karma and those negative, those sickness, all problem from delusion. We have kind of anger, jealous, pride, hatred, attachment. Those all are those all are a kind of root of cause of kind of disease or cause of karma, root cause of karma, root cause of disease. So anyway, disease, sometimes we have many kind of here we're talking about kind of mental disorder, disease, yeah? It's a kind of disorder, disease. Those all disease is, there are many ways to, in Tibetan Buddhist, they don't have kind of specific way to heal those disease. But they heal those disease by doing praying. Okay? Also, those disease, what do you say, heal, identify cause of disease. Is cause of disease. So, first, sometimes this kind of mental disorder, disease caused by, sometimes is caused by, what do we say, is a, I forgot this name is.
You say in Tibetan, maybe
Yon
Jim can help you?
What is some such you know about you? Me mind,
nobody
knows. Yeah, usually we say spiritual in Buddhist people, yeah. It's spirits, yeah. It's caused by some disease, kind of mental disorder, kind of those disease caused by spirits. Those kind of disease, which disease caused by spirits, we can't heal by doing puja. Yeah, hereby doing puja and those kind of disease. Then other kind of disease, we heal by identify the cause of disease. You know, kind of we have mental disorder, yeah? Mental disorder kind of disease. There are also those kind of disease also healed by identify the cause of disease. Cause of disease, we say just like kind of old delusion, yeah? So if you really, in Tibetan, we emphasize on to purify those delusion. If you don't purify those delusion, it's very difficult to heal your mental disorder disease. It's very difficult to heal. So also, what do you say? There are other diseases kind of you can do, you can heal by meditation. Many ways to meditation, and also some diseases you can heal by meditate on compassion. What I know about how to heal the disease. Sometimes you meditate on disease, okay? If I just like, I don't want to talk any religions, nothing, okay? Just like, if I have a kind of disease, so I really have a problem suffering from my disease. How do I heal my disease, sickness? So I meditate on kind of a lightning bolt. You know, it's kind of lightning bolt from the sun, from the moon or sun, something, yeah? This kind of lightning bolt then reflect on all sentient beings, and this kind of lightning bolt dissolve in your mind, and then your mind is reflect, become shiny, and this kind of, by this lightning, then purify your kind of disease. But in Tibetan, we do this kind of meditation. We used to kind of medicine Buddha, then compassion Buddha, meditate those compassion Buddha, those all kind of Buddha, and then we meditate on them, and then their light, their emanate light on our body, and our disease emanated by their light. You think like kind of this way to we meditate and heal our disease, cure our disease. Yeah. So usually we say all disease, those all are come from our mind, project from mind. Yeah, project from mind. So actually, if we example, sometimes we have lots of kind of project mind is very clear because. If your mind is always agitated with some kind of anger, jealous, pride, our mind actually agitated by anger, jealous, pride, yeah? So when your mind is agitated by, during the agitated by jealous anger, then you will never happy and you are always suffer. You have always suffered. Even you go to nice place, even you go to, if you kind of stay in kind of really golden house, yeah? If your mind is kind of agitated with kind of those negative things, you will never be happy, yeah? When your mind is really not agitated with something, yeah? Then you will, even you stay in not fancy house, yeah, you will be happy. This is very true. It's very obvious. So that's why first, if we purify or cure our diseases, first we have to purify all kind of negative from our mind, in our mind stream. Our mind is just like, usually we said, our mind is just like clear sky, just like nature of sky is blue. But sometimes the sky obscured by cloud, you know, obscured by cloud. seems like this. Our mind is really pure. Nature of our mind is very pure. But sometimes our mind obscured by kind of those disease and negative thinking and kind of jealous and angers. Yeah. When you have lots of always, just he mentioned that kind of super jealousy. Yeah.
Super ego.
Just like super ego. He just mentioned like this. When you have really kind of problem, you kind of negative thinking always in your mind. Yeah. Always in your mind. It's become just like in Tibetan we say it's become like your habitual. And it's really caused to reduce your immune system. That's why what we say, our mind is kind of those negative. Actually, we need to high immune system, you know? Yeah? It's caused, those are kind of negative thinking. Okay, jealous, pride, anger. Those all caused to reduce your immune system. And when your immune system go down, then you get sick. This is kind of we way to in Tibetan Buddhists say like this. So that's why we have to really purify our kind of those negative thinking within your mind stream. Yeah. This is a kind of way to cure our disease. Maybe home.
Thank you, Rinpoche. Okay. So now I'd like to invite Dr. Kirkjian, if you'd like to make any comments about the similarities or differences, or if you want to ask Rinpoche any questions,
we'd
like to open it up.
I took lots of notes, so I found one thing that really struck me, and I think I'm going to use this moving forward, is verbal karma. I really like that term. And when you identified three types of karma, verbal, which is speech, body, which in psychiatry would be seen as maybe emotions, and mind is thoughts. So these three things in psychology, we call it the cognitive triad. So there was a guy, a psychologist, his name was Beck. He invented the field of cognitive behavior therapy. So the triad is that we have thoughts. These thoughts then lead to emotions. Then these emotions lead to actions. So if you could modulate your thoughts, then you could kind of reverse engineer the emotions and so I think it's very important when you have these automatic negative thoughts to, when you meditate, you are trying to, through verbal karma or maybe the mind karma, you're trying to purify your mind. So I thought that was a very interesting similarity. And actually, there's a lot more in common with Buddhism now in the field of psychology than there used to be. There is a whole field of psychology called dialectical behavior therapy. And a big component of this type of therapy, this is used to treat personality disorders. One of them is mindfulness. And so what I understand about what mindfulness is the ability to observe without reacting. Another thing is the ability to describe events with words. The third thing is the ability to participate without being self-conscious, to learn spontaneity. So these are all concepts of Buddhism. And another treatment of component of dialectic behavior therapy is meditation. So I think the two fields are diverging more and more, especially with personality disorders nowadays, than a lot of these Freudian concepts and all that kind of thing. But I wanted to ask about, you mentioned something that diseases that are caused by spirits are healed by doing puja.
Yeah.
Can you clarify what puja is?
Yeah, sometimes this kind of I have experience because somebody... usually there are kind of many different pujas to somebody caused by, attacked by spirit, yeah? Mm-hmm. So...
is it like a cleansing type?
Yeah, usually they, in India they do lots of puja. My experience, when I was in India, so it's not my relatives. There's lots of students in the winter. Lots of students come to our monastery. So usually when they come to winter, they have winter vacation for 2 months. Then students, lots of villager students come to the monastery and they study with monks. Then one day there's one student from who came from Tibet. So she's very young. One day she said she has kind of in the daytime she went to somewhere and then she took a picture with one Indian lady. Yeah, Indian lady who wear kind of this kind of black sari. Then at night, maybe 1 o'clock or something, in the midnight, somebody called me, okay, lots of students, everybody there, they are very scared, and she tried to get in the restroom and want to tie, and she says, yeah, I want to go somewhere, and because they called me, this Indian lady called me. Indian lady called me, I have to go now, because at midnight. Then they call me, I went to there, and then at midnight, okay, then everybody doing puja, and then I ask other students to go out, and I'll do puja for her, and then I close door, and then actually she is very strong on that time, just like when on that time, she was very strong, and I cannot really, press down.
Overdone.
She said, I want to go. What happened? Because this Indian lady called me, I want to go. She cried and then crying and yelling, she want to go. And now her face would become red or something. Then I decide, actually we cannot say those old mantra. I decide kind of they have special mantra when they have kind of this problem. Then I decide this mantra and then recite mantra maybe a few times. She just like die. Yeah. Then after maybe a few minutes, then she woke up and then she is better. They're kind of those puja they do, and then those kind of spirit's home, yeah? Mm-hmm. Home by spirit. So yeah, if you don't do puja and if you keep like this, it's cause to become crazy, you know? It's keep then become crazy and it's more problem. That's why when they have kind of those problem in India, we do puja and then cure.
I find the concept of mantra very interesting when you say something.
Yeah, usually they have a special mantra when you have kind of disease or a problem from by spirit. They have kind of mantra of spirit something. They have specific mantra for some kind of disease.
So that's different from meditation where you're repeating a chant, for example.
Yeah, we repeat it and then we do meditate.
But I find it interesting that when you say something out loud or you repeat it, it could actually reverse some negative thoughts. And it's a process that there's evidence in science to show that even though you may feel these emotions and negative thoughts, When you say something verbally, you could reverse that pattern in a way. And I find that to be very practical, and I see the similarities with...
Yeah, it's also similarity. What we do, sometimes they become like crazy. They lost their mind, yeah? Mm-hmm. What do we do? How to change? They kind of way to change mind. What they do? They kind of string, yeah? Mm-hmm. Kind of string, yeah? What do you put on our neck? No necklace, string. We say blessed string.
Oh, blessing.
Yeah, we have kind of blessing string like this. Okay, when they have kind of become crazy or something, yeah? Become kind of, when they lost their mind, what do we do? Tied on their finger. And what do we say? Yeah, we tied their finger, and then we tied very tightly. When you tie tightly, they change their feeling and they kind of then change feeling and they wake up. It's kind of way, just like you mentioned this. It's kind of way to reverse experience, feeling, yeah. Yeah, but puja day is no kind of, how to say, not like this, no kind of way to reverse experience by something tied or not like this.
It's no, different. Puja is different.
Different. Okay, yeah, okay.
And so I also liked that you mentioned that many diseases you could heal by meditation. You meditate on the lightning bolt. And you mentioned the compassion Buddha.
Buddha, okay. Yeah.
How is that different from other types of
usually Buddha? We say our physical body doesn't control our mind. Our mind control our physical body.
Mm-hmm.
Our mind can control our disease.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So if you have really open mind or open mind, big mind, you can control everything. You don't care. But in any way, how do we think? We just like when you do meditate on compassion, then you visualize all other sentient beings suffering. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
You think like this, I'm the only person who has sickness. There are lots of other person has a kind of problem, suffering, mm-hmm. sickness. I am the okay. You just like proud of yourself and then take compassion on other people who are under the suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a kind of way to suppress, reduce your illness. Yeah, because if you always focus on your illness, I have problem, I see, and just like always focus on your illness, then your illness will increase and become getting worse and worse. You just like ignore your illness and think, try to change your mind to something else. So you change to your mind, maybe think some other people who are worse than you under condition. Yeah, it will helpful. Yeah.
So I see a lot of similarities, and I find that reaffirming and validating. I it was very nice to hear some of the things you had to say. What else was I thinking? Move.
Okay, Ruchi, would you like to comment on? Maybe Western psychology, if you found any similarities or differences, or if you have any questions for Dr. Kirk Jin.
Yeah, actually, usually super ego, those kind of ego all are very similar. But Tibetan Buddhism, we have a kind of ego. They have nine ego.
Mm.
Yeah, they have nine ego, different ego. And then it's very difficult to explain in short time.
Mm-hmm.
Even difficult to explain in short time, and also it's difficult for me to explain.
Yeah.
So they have nine ego.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Tibetan, nine ego. Yeah. Just you mentioned that one day is super ego is a part of one.
Internalized parental conscience and societal rules.
Yeah, they have nine.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, nine level of pride. Yeah, nine level of pride. Yeah.
And I also wanted to comment on mindfulness is a very popular topic now. Businesses are using this concept.
It's difficult for me to explain in English. So I have kind of my method summarized something from in my paper.
Mm-hmm.
About karma, maybe it's. I think you are very interested in karma, yeah?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So maybe I read how to.
Okay.
It's kind of karma and how to heal by our illness. So maybe I hope you understand my English.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Here we say, you are karma. Concept of karma in Buddhist, okay? Which literally means action. All of our actions lay down imprints on our mind stream, which have the potential to ripen it sometime in the future. Yeah, these actions can be positive, negative, or neutral. This karmic karmic seeds are never lost. We have all these kind of seeds. We see all these actions. Actions put seeds in your mind. Okay? Then the negative ones can ripen at any time in the form of problem or sickness. Yeah. The positive ones in the form of happiness, health, or success. So we have, say, two kinds of karma, negative karma and positive karma. Negative karma, result of negative karma is kind of sufferings, unhappiness. Result of positive karma is happiness. Yeah? Happiness, kind of happiness or health or success. Then we say, to heal person's sickness. Now how do we heal? Because we say sickness or everything caused by karma, yeah? Now how do we heal? How to cure our sickness? Okay, we say, we have to engage in positive action now. Positive action. So, to prevent sickness occurring again in the future, we have to purify or clear the negative karmic imprints that remain on our mind stream. So sickness, we have to really purify. We have negative karmic imprints in our mind stream. If you don't purify, okay, karmic seeds in within your mind stream, your sickness always will be there. That's what we say. So karma is the creator of all happiness and suffering. We say karma is creator. Yeah. So if we don't have negative karma, we will not get sick or receive harm from other. Buddhism assert that everything that happened to us now is the result of our previous action. So we have lots of suffering now. Yeah. This suffering is kind of come from our previous action. Previous action, if you did something wrong, and if you harm other people, yeah, result will come back on you. Just like, it's very obvious, yeah? If I'm really nice to you, very honestly to you, then you will nice to me, yeah? If I try to cheat you, harm you, in the future, this negative come back on me. Just like, it's very obvious. So here we say our sickness is a result of previous action, not only in the lifetime, but in other lifetime. What we do now determines what will happen to you in the future. If you are really nice, positive, always be positive, your result will be positive. If you always do something negative, result will be negative. Yeah, that's what we say. In terms of present and future healing, the main object to guard our own action, karma, because we have to always check our action to verbal, mental, those action. And then this require constant mindfulness. You just mentioned this, yeah? Constant mindfulness. Yeah. Awareness of all the action of our body, speech, and mind. We should avoid carrying out any actions that are harmful to ourselves and to others. Yeah, Buddhism is therefore a philosophy of total personal responsibility. We have the ability to control our destiny, include the state of our body and mind. Each of us has ultimate potential. What we have to do, develop that potential. Yeah, this is kind of, that's why we say, always we say mind training and check your mind, control your mind. And then if you kind of harmful, if you kind of act, kind of show harmful action to other people, then their result will come on you. It's kind of just like this. That's why everything is a problem, sickness, all things created by karma. That's why we have to heal cause of karma. Cause of karma means, it doesn't mean, is karma is usually in Tibetan Buddhism, is part of mind. is, I just mentioned this, invisible action is part of mind. Our mind is something, act something. Because we're doing something, everything by our mind. Everything projected by mind. That's why we have to control our mind. Yeah? Control our mind. That's why we say that.
And I also like that concept of, in mindfulness, observing without reacting. I think that's kind of like an exercise that strengthens
our mind. Yeah.
It's like every year lifting weights, you know, the concept between how your muscles grow bigger as you do, you know, multiple repetitions.
That's true,
by observing without reacting, it's kind of, the more you repeat that, the stronger your mind will get. So I like that concept. It's very similar.
Yeah. Thank you. So
okay, so I guess I would like to open up to questions. If anybody has a question for either Dr. Kirkjian or Rinpoche or both of them, I'll pass the mic on to you. Yeah, sure.
Hello, my name is Jennifer, and the question is for Rinpoche.
Yeah. Okay.
My question is, are there mental hospitals or behavioral health facilities in Tibet? And are there practicing psychiatrists in Tibet?
Actually, in Tibet, they don't have specific mental hospital. Yeah? So, actually, in Tibet, the people who has kind of, but they have medicine, mental medicine, because usually Tibetan, this mental problem caused by loss of wind energy, you know? That wind energy, they have kind of medicine that reduce your wind, because your old wind come up on your shoulder somewhere, then you have kind of get depression and pressure and those kind of lots of things come in your mind, you know, depression, pressure, yeah? If your wind is really, what you say, is kind of neutral, yeah? If the wind is really normal, then you will not have no problem. Usually we say all problem, we have sickness, mental problem. Those all are is a imbalance of four elements. Yeah? If your wind too much high, then you will have problem. Kind of maybe pressure or something. Yeah, that's why they have kind of medicine, but they don't have specific mental hospital. Yeah.
And then a follow-up question: what type of doctors or practitioners treat people with mental health disorders in Tibet?
Yeah, usually in Tibet, when we have mental problem, they always try to do puja for them. And they take care and do puja, and then, but they also eat Tibetan medicine, because we just do this way. Then also we try to take care of them by whatever they want. Just give them, try to free, because if you too much force them to do your way, it's very difficult to cure their problem, yeah? Try to do whatever they want, and then, but we take care by this way, but we don't have specific kind of, hospital for them, yeah.
Thank you.
But we do lots of puja.
I have a question. It's for you.
Okay.
What's the best practice when it comes to meditation? Like, we live in a very busy world, right? So most of us don't even have 10 minutes, 15 minutes a day for ourselves. We run, you know, as quick as we can. We get out of the showers.
Yeah, that's true.
Hop into
the
car. Go to the, you know, go through traffic, right? And then we snap when things go wrong, right? So people, you know, I think would benefit from meditating first thing in the morning.
Yeah, usually, you know, actually, there are two kinds of meditation. Yeah, is meditation only? Meditation doesn't mean you just like sit like in posture and just stay like sit alone at your house. No, like kind of this. Anyway, if you have time, you can do this way. But meditation means is really point is kind of control your mind, familiar your mind with something. Yeah,
your mind.
Yeah, control your mind. Meditation you can use your workplace. Yeah? Meditation means try to focus on one thing. When you walk, try to focus on one thing and try to ignore whatever people complain and whatever they say. Try to focus on one object. That means meditation. Even the kind of meditation you can use at your workplace. Yeah? Because in workplace, we have really lots of pressure and depression kind of pressure problem because we have something, our mind absorb everything from the other people's, yeah? Other people's action, other people's complaint, and other people's then blah, 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 everything in your mind, and then our mind is just like, become like trash. Right. Trash can, put everything inside, and if you put everything inside in trash can, it cannot use, you know? It's useless to become, yeah? That's why, if you use something, yeah, just like, yeah, put nice things, just like we use useful things you put in the fridge and we used to eat, yeah? Just like this, when you go to workplace, be positive and try to kind of nice things and kind of useful things, meaningful things, try to put in your mind and other kind of complaint and other people's behavior and which one you don't like. You don't have to put in your mind, you just don't care. Yeah? Then your mind will be stable.
I guess it's easier said than done to be positive, right?
Yeah, that's easy.
If you go through, let's say people go through difficult times, you know, you don't have any bill, you know, you got bills to pay, you got sickness, health, crisis, and all that. What do you suggest?
Yeah, this is, I just mentioned that when you have bill pay and in problem, yeah?
Right.
This kind of way to you, just like people who are worse than you. You have to build pay, you have something to do, but still you can do, you have potential to do, you have ability to do, but some homeless people, you think, you just feel like you're lucky yourself, feel lucky yourself, think other people, like homeless people, yeah, other people who don't take care in the hospitals, that's like this, yeah, you're lucky, you just like appreciate by yourself. Than other people who don't have anything, just like homeless people, you see? We say, oh, I have to take care of home, I have to take care of blah, 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 something, but what should we do, homeless people, they sleep on the street, they don't have nothing, you see? Yeah, that's why we have too much desire, you know, right. Attachment, that's why you just like appreciate by yourself than other people, think other people, it's really kind of, that's why what we say, if I have really kind of gastric or something problem, sick problem, okay? When we sick, then we think, oh, people whose sickness, disease, worse than my sick. Then I think, oh, some people, they sick. They almost die, but nobody take care. They don't have money to go to hospital. Just like, I'm lucky. I have a house. I have money to go to hospital. Just that you have to be appreciate yourself and then reduce your problem, you know?
So be thankful.
Yeah, thankful and grateful every be
day.
Positive. That's what we say. Optimistic and what we say? Optimistic, yeah? Be
altruistic.
Altruistic, yeah.
Be thankful of what you have and not what you don't have.
Yeah, that's,
yeah. Very good, very good.
Yeah.
I just want to get back, like what you were saying, though, and get back to you. And I used to be thinking that quite a bit a while ago, that we live in a real busy world, with family, kids, work, too much.
Yeah.
When are you going to put 15 minutes of or 20 minutes of meditation? And I think for me, it became a point where it was very important, my mental health, and to really know more of my insight, what was really going in my mind. And so I took that time and made the time. So like if I wanted to become really strong, like you were saying about lifting weights,
yeah.
Then I had to make it for sure that I would go to the gym half hour in order to increase my muscles. Well, I started to do that,
yeah.
And I made it to where it had to fit my schedule.
Yeah.
If it was too busy, and I found out that early in the morning for me, early in the morning worked well because at 4:00, 4:30 in the morning, nobody is going to bug you, nobody's going to, you know, call you on the phone, etc. Chances are much less than at 10 o'clock in the morning. So I started to find out what worked for me and within my schedule and put that in practice. And now it's a habit. It's there and it's got to be done. And so I think that's an important, I think, factor to include that in. And because I think when we say that, it's still the mind that is not allowing those things. I going back to what you said about the mind being agitated many times, well, you can't really get into the mind and find out what's going on if you're agitated. It is to calm it down first, to clear it down, to peaceful down, and then to get into the mind and find out what's going on in there. And I think the important thing, like someone said before to me, I think is to get into the mind, find out what's going on, and to really follow those thoughts that are going to cause you problems to where they actually are starting, the roots, where they're stemming from, where they're coming from to the surface of the mind, and cut them at the bottom. Someone said this little saying that I like, you know, do not allow the spark to become a flame. Cut it when it's a spark. But that needs to be really aware of what's going on. And this is where I think meditation comes in. And it's very, very important to do that. Somebody said, if you're going to have a hell of a day, make sure you meditate a little longer that day. You know, mm-hmm. Before you go to that. So that's my point with going back to that. That's about all.
I actually had two questions in one.
Okay.
For the holding the reaction, being mindful, at what point do you do something with the reaction? And does it ever come out, I guess?
So that's an interesting point, is that I had a great mentor, Dr. Muradi. He was the head of UCLA, and he was really a Jungian therapist. He taught us family therapy. And one of the things that he stressed is that when you observe and you don't react, that tension creates a creative third. I don't know what that means, the creative third, but by not reacting and by observing that kind of tension and letting you to think about it and meditate on it, you find out maybe you look at the situation and you see how it evolves if you hadn't reacted to the situation. And you might learn something when you remove yourself from reacting. I could give you guys one example of how I learned this. Is that in residency, we do this thing called the Tavistock, where a bunch of the residents sit in a room and there's two neutral observers who make comments on the group dynamic. So one of the things they encouraged me to do in this Tavistock to learn something about myself was to do something the opposite of what I normally do. So in a group setting, I found out that I was the anxiety sink. So the way I try to solve problems in a big group is that I tend to absorb the anxiety of everyone in the group so that to make everyone feel better. So one day I went into this group and I decided I'm going to be a mime. I'm going to be mute. I'm not going to say anything to alleviate the anxiety of the other people. I'm just going to stay quiet. And so when I did that, everyone in my group started unraveling. They were getting more and more anxious. They were pushing me. They were trying to get me to talk, to get me to fill my normal role that I fill in the group. But I resisted. And when I resisted that natural reaction, I learned something about myself, is that I assumed this role in the group of absorbing the anxiety of other people. And when I saw how much anxiety I did not take on myself, I saw that anxiety all of a sudden come out of me and go all to everyone else. Like I saw it like a wildfire. So I think that's one example of how resisting a reaction, you might learn something about how you react to certain situations. So it's different for everyone, but that's just, that's kind of my observation of how I learned by that, the creative third, by, you just see, because like coming back to cause and effect, everything, every action has a reaction. So sometimes inaction has a reaction too. So I just learned that about myself. So that's just my example of you know, the observing and not reacting.
Yeah, good point. And then on the meditation, when you say focus on one thing, what's an example of what one thing is?
Yeah, usually in we have two kinds of, I just mentioned that meditation, analyzation meditation and single-pointed meditation, yeah? Single-pointed meditation means you can't use any objects. Any objects, even you meditate on just like object used to meditate on table. Just like you try to keep your mind, try to focus on your mind on the table as much as you can. That means kind of way to, it's kind of method to, method to stop your distraction, distracting mind. Because we have lots of distracting mind, just like, because that's why we have a problem. Our mind is, we just mentioned that like monkey. Monkey cannot stay on the tree few minutes, yeah? Jump here, jump here, jump here, just, our mind, here, observe everything, you know? So that means the kind of method to avoid your distracting mind and try to focus just on this table. Yeah, later when you're familiar, then you can keep focus, maybe year, yeah. That's why the Tibetan they do. Yeah.
And just quickly, when you spoke about wind, I wasn't sure what that was.
Usually, in a this wind in Tibetan kind of medical terms, and also in Buddhist, we have kind of sutra and tantra. Yeah, sutra and tantra. So usually we see we have in a tantra they have many kinds of wind. They have kind of coarse wind and subtle wind. Subtle wind is really we say indivisible subtle mind, because usually say in a we Buddhist. Tibetan Buddhists say tantra way, when you die, when I die, yeah? Better to use I die. Okay. Anyway, everybody die, maybe I'm used to me, it's better, yeah? When I die, okay? When I die, dissolve. Is there a, kind of way to dissolve your body, yeah? Is a kind of, usually say, 25, yeah? 25, yeah? Cause so, first we say, when we think, when we die, we dissolve everything together. No. First when we die, then just like dissolve, first you lose your eye side, then ear side, then tongue side. Everything, they have kind of sign. You know, because when we die, but we cannot talk. But still, your mind is inside. Yeah? When your mind inside, when you dissolve your ear consciousness, eye consciousness, tongue consciousness, dissolve, you have kind of sign. They have different sign. You know, the sign is coming in your mind. Then after, then mental, then ear, eye, then body, body consciousness. After those all kind of consciousness dissolve, disappear, then you have only subtle mind. That's we say remain only subtle mind. Yeah? This remain, this kind of subtle mind is indivisible of a subtle wind. Yeah. Yeah. Usually we say also in Western, they said, anyway, it's a little bit irrelevant, your question. Because in Western, they said, when we have sometimes somebody just like heart bumping. Also, they have really kind of shoulder pain, too much pain, yeah? This is kind of problem from your wind, too much wind. This is kind of medical activation. Terms, yeah?
Like activation or maybe
yeah, medical terms,
thoughts
yeah.
or something.
Yeah, right? Medical terms, because when you study, you spend lots of time to study, yeah? You have shoulder pain or something. They have Tibetan special medicine. If you eat this kind of medicine, it's really good. Yeah, this is a, actually is a, in medical terms of wind, and then also tantra bad terms of wind is a little bit different. Yes. Yeah, usually wind, they have a kind of definition of wind.
I kind of want to bring it back into the scientific and the clinical aspects. I was fascinated to hear you say that you think that schizophrenia is attributable to diet. I have quite a bit of experience dealing, didn't you say?
Diet? No, biology.
Oh, biology, okay.
Yeah, versus psychology.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. So I have quite a bit of experience dealing with schizophrenic and bipolar people. And my first experience was when I was very, very young. I was about maybe 24, and a family friend locked himself. He was maybe 18. He locked himself into his room and for the entire weekend was chanting the Bible and then broke, snapped. And he was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and the only person he would talk to was me. So I would go to the hospital and try to speak to this kid, and he was quite lucid. Yes, he was on Thorazine and all kinds of other drugs, but then later, I don't know if you've ever seen this documentary about this young girl in L.A., who they've studied since she was about 4 or 5 years old. She was diagnosed with schizophrenia when I think she was 6 or 5. She also has a brother. Her schizophrenia is so acute and was so extraordinary to watch the progression of her schizophrenia. And then her brother is now diagnosed with schizophrenia. She's about 12 years old now. And I'm kind of fascinated as to really what's going on in schizophrenia that is not going on in bipolar necessarily.
Sure. Same
because
thing.
It's the yeah. same thing. As, I mean, well, not exactly, but there's a lot of similarities between schizophrenic behavior and bipolar behavior.
Same concept with autism, how we see so much autism now. I also think there's a huge cultural component. There, in other countries where they're less individualistic and more society mindful of others and part of a society, I tend to see that people who have mental illness don't kind of fall by the wayside, because they tend to fill a role because they're in more of a communal type society. And it's kind of like Sal Mnuchin, who's a famous family therapist. He says that the individual does not exist. But I think in a lot of psychology, it's very individualistic. It's all about diagnoses and semantics. But when I come to meetings like this, I see that it's not so much about the semantics, but how we could help other people, you know, how actions, you know, the karma is all about taking positive action. Same thing in the different types of therapy. And I think it's beautiful. And I also believe that when I see where God is in the world is in that space when two people are trying to understand one another or help one another. So I see that is all kind of the same thing. But it's interesting how you mentioned that schizophrenia is so different from other mental illness. You know, anxiety, neuroses, personality disorders, these are much more amenable to treatment with therapy. But, when I see very classic schizophrenic patients, there's a time around age 19 in males, late 20s in females. It's a very well documented, and it's multi, it's very heterogeneous illness. So that, let's say, there's 1,000 different points in your brain where if you have an insult or an injury during early childhood development, it could lead to the manifestation of schizophrenia. So there, you know, how in some diseases, there's one specific brain lesion that leads to a very obvious manifestation. The problem with schizophrenia is that it's so heterogeneous, but you get that same clinical picture. They have the same delusions. They have the disorganized thoughts. So it's an interesting area that's developed. There's a lot of theories about a lot of schizophrenics tend to be born in the month of November.
Oops, that's my
No,
who would know?
No, but the field of epidemiology is very interesting because there are certain viruses that are seasonal. And, you know, there are very, and some pregnant women that are delivering their baby in that month or whatever, that child might be susceptible to a certain virus that the mother has, or, you know, so there's this whole burgeoning, you know, people are trying to figure out what's the root cause of it, which is still, you know, evolving. But it's, as a psychiatrist, given that I've seen thousands of patients, it's just so predictable, the pattern. When I see someone who's schizophrenic, I could identify it right away versus something more vague like a bipolar or other type of mental illness.
What really struck me about these two children, mm-hmm. is that you don't hear that much about children at the age of 5 or 6 having schizophrenia, mm-hmm. although her responses were very schizophrenic, but they were also very bipolar. So what's going on in children that they're suddenly finding allegedly schizophrenia? Doesn't make sense.
Statistically, this is very rare. There's a terminology, it's called early onset schizophrenia and very early onset schizophrenia. If you look at the general population, I believe it's like 1% or 0.1% for that very early onset type. So, you know, there are certain clinics like the Menninger Clinic or whatever that really evaluate, work up these cases, but thankfully it's very rare. But examples like this point out that it's not the parents messing up the child. Sometimes there's a biological component.
Yeah. Definitely going to be my major. For Rinpoche, along the lines of schizophrenia and bipolar, we've had a little experience with that here in the past. So my question with regard to Buddhism and the mind and these serious illnesses like bipolar and schizophrenia, how, and I don't ever remember hearing anything about Tibetans having schizophrenia or bipolar or even serious depression. So how do we know our mind is really manifesting schizophrenia and not just manifesting our karma from 1,000 lifetimes before?
This is a very good question.
Do you understand what I mean?
Maybe it's kind of. Maybe, yeah. So, your question is, how do we know the kind of this disease, yeah? How do we know, yeah?
How do we know that schizophrenia and maybe bipolar, how do we know we are not create, how do we identify as Buddhists that we are creating these manifestations of schizophrenia, which is delusions and all kinds of outbursts of not even really being here and now, and bipolar being, you know, crazy one day and depressed after the crash. So how do we know that as Buddhists we are not creating that in our mind, but that it is a genuine diagnosis? Is that what I kind of said?
This kind of disease is a part of mental disorder disease, yeah?
Right, yes.
Yeah, actually this is very, it's, in Tibetan Buddhism is very clear. So mental disorder is coming from by you not control your mind. Mm-hmm. You know? Mental disorder. If you always keep your mind, I just mentioned that, if you always keep your mind with negative thinking, okay? So I just mentioned that if you put everything, just like, if you put everything in the trash, you know? You just like, everything just put in trash, it will become useless. Just like if you get some kind of virus in the computer, you know? If you lots of things put in your computer, just like, in your mind, if you put lots of kind of negative thinkings and a lot of kind of delusion, yeah, kind of useless thinking. Always, if you always use in your mind, then your mind, you become kind of, you will have mental disorder. Mental disorder means is come from without controlling your mind.
Okay, so then flip to the doctor. If we're talking about mental disease as coming from the mind, and we're talking about schizophrenia or bipolar, which we know bipolar is clearly some problems within the brain, the sides of the brain, and in schizophrenia, the delusion aspect. How do we reconcile this?
I think a lot of it, like, rather than trying to figure out the semantics of why we have it, I think there's more commonality with how we treat these things. And just because you're schizophrenic, it doesn't mean you can't benefit from meditation.
Right.
I think that maybe sometimes if it's very severe, there might be a role for medication to play to quell the mind enough so that you can practice meditation and strengthen some of your own coping skills. I mean, it's very controversial. There's not a lot of studies, but you know, in the older analysts, they used to do therapy with schizophrenic patients. But the way that we're trained now is just so focused on medication. And I don't fault a lot of the younger psychiatrists because they never received a lot of the psychoanalytic or psychodynamic. I mean, psychoanalytic is kind of passé now. A lot of the theories have been kind of, you know, they're not commonly accepted, but a lot of CBT, mindfulness, dialectic behavior therapy, these are all very powerful, even in severe cases of bipolar or schizophrenia. But, you know, the thing is, I can't even, with all the research out there, no one knows the one specific cause of schizophrenia. But I like to think that the role that I play is if someone is so severe clinically, I could bring them down to earth a little bit so that they could actually learn coping mechanisms, or they could benefit from therapy or from meditation or from doing these actions that kind of reverse some of the patterns, maladaptive patterns in the brain. So it's, you know, karma, whether you like to call it karma or the nine egos or the superego or the id, I think a lot of all semantics. And I remember when I was in my training, I had an affinity towards one type of psychology, like object relations or, you know, self-psychology. But then my mentor told me that as people get older and more experienced, they tend to not identify with one. You know, if you interview a group of young psychiatrists or therapists, you see that everyone goes into their different schools of thought. As you get more experience and older, it's almost like they tend to more merge more towards universal principles. And that's what I'm kind of, I'm finding more of an affinity towards more universal principles now. I see a lot of commonalities with Buddhism and some of the techniques in psychology. So, when this opportunity was presented to me to be a guest lecturer, I really wanted to learn more about how different people view some of the things that I view them as.
I just find it interesting that with bipolar, we really have to treat them usually with medication. So how, Rinpoche, with meditation, can we treat bipolar?
I'm really not sure kind of this disease name, so that's why.
Bipolar is mostly manic state, very agitated, angry, crazy, and that can go on for maybe 2, 3, 4 days, and then all of a sudden, boom, they crash down into a depression. Their brain is bipolar is two sides of the brain, so it's both sides are kind of out of whack. And really the only way that a bipolar patient can function, if they're really acute, is through medication. So I'm wondering how we treat the bipolar specifically with meditation or with Buddhist principles.
Yeah, that's what I just mentioned. It's contrary to my try to be calm down. That's what we see, yeah? If then that's why I know you, how do you calm down, yeah? So I'm really not sure. This maybe they If you have some idea,
well,
her question.
What you said earlier, doctor, what you said earlier is the fact that to bring them down to the point when they are able to control those mood swings, where they're able to be more stable on the mood swings, where you can get them then to get in there and to practice meditation, and for them to learn how to control those swings from going back and forth.
Yeah, I don't think medication and meditation are what's that term? They're not mutually mutually exclusive, right? So I think a big stigma is that people assume that because I'm a psychiatrist, I believe that medications are the cure to all problems. That's not necessarily how I think. But and I think maybe you wouldn't disagree that sometimes you had mentioned that there are some herbal medications for specific winds, right?
Yeah.
So it's the same concept, I guess, with psychiatric medication, that you're treating a specific symptom. You're not trying to cure someone of an underlying cause of something, you know. But I think the answer is somewhere in the gray area. I don't think there's any there's any one specific epiphany that might answer this question, and it's an evolving field. So it's very interesting that we have these type of dialogues.
We have another question over here.
It's for the doctor, because here I've been learning a lot about the mind, like everything is coming from our inner instead of the external. And I know a lot of times, like I would run into ours. Problems at work, and like a lot of people, I feel bad for them because they don't know like the meditations, you know, like to have like calm, peaceful mind. And I saw like people like they with depression, okay, and like I want to know like the pills that you've been giving to them, like how does it help them? Like I know like the pills thing is just temporary. Am I correct?
Yeah, but depression is a very good illness that could respond to meditation, because depression is based on an automatic maladaptive thought, or when people ruminate on something. So by like, I'm sorry if I mispronounced it, Rambushan. Rambushan. I'm really sorry. I'm bad with names.
He's like,
the one thing that hit me like a lightning bolt when I heard him speak, that he said it with great passion, is that the mind controls the body. Is that, no matter how anxious we feel, if we strengthen our mind, we could reverse those emotions, and then that will lead to better actions. You know, it's like that triangle. So thoughts, emotions, actions. It's kind of, if you do the meditation, you practice, you could then reverse how you feel. It's going to take time. It doesn't happen automatically. But there's different medications. For depression, we typically use SSRIs, which are antidepressants that increase serotonin levels. Sometimes people who have had very traumatic early child traumas, they tend not to develop as much serotonin. So sometimes, chronic negative experiences or abuse or neglect could lead to low serotonin levels, for example. And so the medication seems to elevate the levels of that chemical. But you could also increase serotonin levels by, reversing those thoughts and by practicing mindfulness and spontaneity. You kind of, because a lot of mental illness is just habits, bad patterns. We have to break these habits, and mindfulness helps us to break out of that. Like, that's why one of the components of mindfulness is to be, not to be self-conscious, to practice spontaneity. Because when you practice spontaneity, you're strengthening the part of your brain that is the creative part, the problem-solving part, rather than falling back into automatic rituals of negative patterns and stuff like that. So the medications are just to help. Hopefully, the goal is that when you do medication plus therapy together, when you learn enough coping skills, then you could rely on the coping skills to solve your problems in the future rather than depending on the medication.
Okay, and you mentioned about like therapy, right? So how does, you know, like the therapy help like someone with depressions, like maybe didn't even know like that person had depressions and found out, okay, got depressions. So how does that therapy things work? Like what exactly that you doing like to help that person, like to help that person speak up, or like, you know, like, oh, what therapy? Is it like dialect therapy or?
Yeah, so I had described, because the field of psychology is so broad, I described a couple of therapies that I tend to, I like a lot. One of them is object relations therapies. It's very complicated to get into, but Melanie Klein is a specific therapist who did this. There's an English pediatrician, his name is Winnicott. He talked a lot about early attachments, object relations, transference-based therapy. So transference, I was discussing earlier, is that is what happens between a patient and a therapist. Any kind of feelings that happen during therapy between the therapist, let's say the patient shows up 5 minutes late every time to the session, sometimes the therapist will say, oh, I noticed that you were 5 minutes late today, I wonder if there's anything, or you process the here and now. Anything that's happening in the room here and now, you're working on transference. That's transference is when the patient projects feelings onto the therapist. The therapist might remind them of someone in their life, either someone positive that they're idealizing or someone negative. So that when you're working on transference, which is here and now, that's psychodynamic therapy. So that's one style. Another style is cognitive behavior therapy. So cognitive behavior therapy, the therapist helps the patient identify automatic maladaptive thoughts. So, for example, one of them is, oh, I'm never going to be good enough, or no matter how hard I try, I'm not going to get better. So you take those quotes and you start identifying patterns, like how often these different feelings are coming up, and you make a hierarchy. You list them from 1 to 10. The one that's the most fearful, you list as number 1. The one that's least fearful, you list as number 10. And you slowly, you challenge those negative thoughts with evidence. You know, you show them, well, if you think that you are never going to accomplish anything in life, then how is it that you you did well in your job? How is it that you received this award? Or how is it that you've raised these two kids and you've done a good job with that? So it's like you're a lawyer in court and you're making an argument to the judge. You're presenting evidence to the person. And when this person says these things out loud and hears you challenging their automatic negative thoughts, those thoughts, they become less powerful in your head. So it's like the more you expose light into a dark room, the smaller a shadow gets. So there's a theory of the shadow in Jungian therapy where when you are constantly hiding in the dark and you see a little light coming, there's a big shadow. So the more light you shed on the situation, the shadow shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. So the shadow is like your automatic negative thoughts. If you focus too much on them, it grows like the Hulk. It gets powerful. But when you shed light on those thoughts, which is like logic, evidence of different things you've accomplished in your life, it helps the shadow to shrink. So that's kind of the theory about how therapy helps people. And there's different theories, so I just wanted to point out that some theories focus on the ego, the superego, and the id. Other theories focus on the relationships between people. Family therapy focuses on the dynamic of the family. That's the guy Sal Mnuchin. Look his videos up on YouTube. He's very funny. he points out how some people in a group, they become an identified patient, and they try to figure out how to unblock these patterns. So there's different philosophies. There's a bunch of different therapies. So just because one therapy doesn't fit or doesn't work for for you, it doesn't mean that it's all the same and you should give up. But there are different therapies for different conditions. But at the same time, dialectic behavior therapy is almost like Buddhism. You know, it teaches you skills like mindfulness, meditation. That's more for like the personality disorders, people with borderline personality or narcissistic personality or neurotic personalities, you know, those type of things. Anxiety, depression, all of these conditions are very amenable towards treatment with meditation. The one area that's hard to treat with that are things like bipolar, maybe schizophrenia, autism. You know, these are more kind of biologically based. The brains in people with autism are different. You know, in the first year of life, their brain goes too big. So a lot of times what we do as psychiatrists is we get a tape measure for kids and we do head circumference. So head circumference is a big sign of screening for autism. You know, so there's a lot of mental illness that there's more like 60% biology versus 40% psychology. You know, so every case is different. Every diagnosis is different. But I think part of my role to come here is to educate people that there's different types of therapy. Therapy is not all the same for every condition. There's different schools of thought, cognitive behavior therapy, psychodynamic therapy, dialectic behavior therapy. But I hope that answers some of your question.
Sure. Yeah. You did. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm very happy.
Does anybody have any other questions? Yeah.
I just have a quick clarifying question for the doctor. So there's all these different schools of psychology, but is it true that all of them basically assert that a person is born sane, but then due to various external things like people and environments and chemicals, they become insane and they have these problems?
So most schools of psychology have that concept that either you were breastfed too much or you weren't breastfed enough, or there's the good breast, the bad breast, the good enough mother, you know. there's all the transitional objects, you know, traumas in your early development. So a lot of psychology used to focus on this, but as a psychiatrist, I also see that there are some total fallacies with regards to describing schizophrenia or bipolar as an early developmental trauma or some sort of diffuse ego identity led to schizophrenia. So I think the more research and the more science is out there, we're seeing different differences in the brains of schizophrenics with the lateral ventricles, for example. They do a lot of CAT scans, MRIs, and people with schizophrenia, they have severe differences in their brain structure than normal people. So the whole field of biology and mental illness is kind of burgeoning right now. I think some of these concepts are helpful for more of the other type, like for anxiety, for depression. Those type of psychological theories are better at explaining some of these conditions.
All right, thank you.
Okay, anybody else? Last questions? Oh, yep, one more.
So you say you are a psychiatrist, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing, like, to deal, you know, like, with your patients. And that's more like personal questions. So how do you deal with, you know, like, people with, you know, like, mental, extreme mental illness like that? How do you deal with your own mental mind?
Do you mean how do I prevent?
How do you cope?
How do I separate it?
How do you cope it? Yeah.
Well, you know, for some people who are very severely ill, the statistics.
Okay, sorry, I keep going in and out. Is it working?
Yeah.
So there's the rule of thirds. Sometimes people with schizophrenia, a third of them get better, a third of them stay the same, and a third get worse. So I have to adjust my expectations. If 66% of the patients I'm working with are either staying the same or getting better, then that's good enough for me. You know, surgeons may have a different mentality where they want 100% success rate, but for me, I try to be more realistic Because if I don't do this work, then someone else may not do it. So I try not to look at it as this is painful to me, but if I wasn't doing it, maybe these people wouldn't be getting the help that they're getting. You know, so I try to look at it as like I'm doing the best that I can in the situation that I'm in my life, you know, and I've, you know, for whatever reason, I gave you the example of how I was the anxiety sink. So maybe in my own family, I learned how to resolve a lot of conflict, and I grew up in a chaotic situation, and that kind of prepared me for what I do in my work. But, you know, it's important, like those exercises, I have to not absorb too much anxiety. So for me, it's important that my wife and I, you know, spend good quality time with each other. We travel a lot. There's no television in our house. We talk a lot. Because my work is very stressful and her work is very stressful. So, you know, I try to always keep open lines of communication and self-care. I always schedule vacation. You know, and one thing I always, one philosophy I believe in that is that happiness comes from experiences, not possessions. So I think that's a big thing for me, is to have multiple positive experiences. I like to travel, and you know, we love food, experiencing different cultures, and I think the best way to do that is through food. So I'm a big foodie. So so the harder I work, the more vacations we take. So it's like an equilibrium. So, so sure.
Does anybody have any other questions?
I just wanted to make a comment about the concept of karma in Buddhism and the field of psychoneuroimmunology and, you know, the Western world. So the concept of karma is, you know, your action will have a specific reaction. So any action that you take will always... you'll always have like a specific, there will be a specific reaction that will affect you. And so with, you know, psychoneuroimmunology, I guess, you know, the thoughts that you think, whether negative or positive, will cause a cascade of like reactions in your body that will either strengthen or weaken your immune system. So I just kind of, you know, noted that similarity between the Western explanation of karma and then the Buddhist tradition.
What is time?
Okay, so I guess we'll end with maybe some closing remarks. Maybe Rinpoche, you want to give a couple closing remarks, and then Dr. Kurjin, and then we'll end.
What do you want to do?
Anything you want to say at the... If not, we could just...
Okay.
Do some puja.
I'm confused because he told me quote something. I wonder if I want to decide something.
No, any closing thoughts? Any thoughts? Anything you want to say at the end? That's
okay,
it.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing to quote.
Okay. thank you very much for coming here. I'm really... appreciate, and I'm really happy to see I've forgotten, I'm sorry, Dr. Kurjin Paul.
Yes.
I'm very, so this we have this center since what, 1994,
I think.
Yeah, 1994, and we have center maybe here forever. Even we're going to die forever. And so we welcome you anytime when you have time. We really appreciate, and we are very, and we are really happy to share with the idea of different perspective between Western psychology, kind of thought of Western psychology, yeah?
mm-hmm. Western psychology and Buddhist psychology. Usually we say Buddhist, in Buddhist we said there's a two types of kind of, we said Buddhist ritual, and what we learn here talking about mind is kind of Buddhist science. Mm-hmm. So actually also in India we have every year we have kind of Buddhist conference. If you're really interested to go there in the future, we have kind of conference between Tibetan Buddhism and Western. There are lots of Western scientists and psychologists go there in India, and they have every year they have a big conference. Maybe this year they have usually they hold conference end of year. Maybe if you go there, I think so it's really beneficial. So in the Buddhists, they don't have kind of particular how to cure kind of people who has kind of mental disorder and kind of those problem. Yeah, it's really beneficial for Buddhist practitioner. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's very educational because we saw a lot of similarities in both. Like we were being in the psychiatric perspective and now knowing your perspective, like it was very refreshing to find a lot of similarities. And I think we need the education to be able to bring to, like, this was very informative, and but this is a small group that I think if we could bring it to more people, it would be very beneficial.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I guess the Mind and Life conferences are the ones that you refer to. I don't know you're aware of them, but they've been going on since 2000.
Okay.
And fantastic. Those who did not know, you must look at it. You must. And so that's the one he's referring to.
And since we love to travel, I would love to go there.
Okay. If you love travel, then we welcome you to India, and we have organizer and every day, everything over there. So we welcome you. Yeah.
From all kinds of different. Does it come in different therapies, psychiatrists, psychologists,
sure.
Name it, Buddhist people from different countries, they come in every year, top scientists.
And I wanted to thank you for having me here. It was a great pleasure. Thank you for the Tibetan gesture. But like I said, I truly see that it's very beautiful when people exchange ideas. And I truly believe that God is present in between two people who are trying to understand each other or help each other or help everyone in the world. So
that's true, really.
I think it's very important to constantly share ideas and learn from other people. And diversity diversity in the human race is such a rich, powerful source of energy that people don't use. You know, people stick to their own theories, and I think it's important to exchange ideas.
Yeah, so. It's really important. Yeah.
All right, let's give a big round of applause to both of our guests. Thank you, Dr. Kirk Jim. We have a gift for you somewhere around here. There it is. It's Rocio put this together, so this is for you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming and blessing us with your presence. Yeah. I'd also like to thank Rocio. Without Rocio's connection to Dr. Kirkjian, we wouldn't be able to have this event. So thank you, Rocio. And lastly, there's coffee and tea in the back, so please enjoy, and some snacks as well. Otherwise, thank you for coming, and I hope to see you soon at the next guest speaker series.
No problem.
Thank you very much.
I learned
a
lot.
We hope you. Yeah. We hope to see you next time.
Yes. Okay. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Did it affect the audio of the
video? I'm not too sure. It should be fine. Okay. Oh, sorry.
Okay.
We got that little...
Through my scarf.
There we go. Okay.